This season of Huddled Masses, Battleground, wouldn't be possible without our sponsors. As we slowly adjust to a new normal, we still need to be smart about how we do business. Luckily, there's Stamps.com to make things easier. With Stamps.com, you can print postage on demand, get discounted rates, and now, since I last tried out the service, UPS has been added as a carrier. Stamps.com brings all the mailing and shipping services you need right to your computer in the comfort of your own home or office. 24/7, any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send it. And once your mail's ready, you just leave it for your mail carrier. Schedule a pickup or drop it in the mailbox. It's simple. And with Stamps.com, you get 5 cents off every stamp and up to 62% off USPS and UPS shipping rates. Right now, my listeners get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and type in masses, as in huddled masses. That's stamps.com, enter masses. Hello, I'm Alex Hannaford, and this is Battleground.
And I'm producer Pete. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. How are you, Pete?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. So why don't you tell us a little bit about today's podcast? What's it about?
Today's podcast is about the coronavirus.
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 This is obviously an election podcast. Why do you think it feeds into the election?
World's worst affected country.
This is a horrible plague that beset us.
We're in a situation where there is a great crisis.
I'm still completely baffled by this. So why is a pandemic, why has that become an electoral issue? But it has. It's divided the country like much else in America at the moment. It's just become another issue that has driven a wedge between the left and the right. And it is bonkers that this has happened. And I want to find out why.
And how are you doing that today? Who are you going to be speaking to?
I'm speaking to a guy called Craig Spencer.
Dr. Craig Spencer.
Whose proper title is
the Director of Global Health Emergency Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center in New York.
And he is a fascinating guy. He also works in the accident and emergency department of a hospital in New York.
And what are some of the issues that you'll be talking to him about?
You know, he's been through a hell of a lot this year already. He's been working on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic. The reason I wanted to speak to Craig is because he's been very vocal. He's become this sort of personality on Twitter.
And his tweets yesterday about his life in the ER these last few days and weeks got a lot of notice.
You know, he has this incredible story of working on the front lines of the pandemic, but he's also really experienced some of the pushback from certain quarters about the virus and the misinformation surrounding it. And he, you know, people even doubting the very existence of COVID-19. So he, you know, him and some other doctors have taken to Twitter and social media to try and counter this narrative, which they think is really dangerous, frankly. In the interview, we try and get some place of understanding about why on earth this has happened and what we can do about it to give people proper information.
He told us after the interview that it was the longest interview he'd done with anyone since he spoke to Obama and Joe Biden. So we're in good company.
That's right. We are. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He told us at the end that he had done an interview with Obama and Biden about the coronavirus. I guess they wanted to find out more from him about, fighting it and the challenges he faced.
Should also say that we spoke to him towards the end of August, and also that he was on holiday, taking a well-earned break from A&E.
He was.
And he was in New Hampshire, I believe.
He was. He was in his car. So he turned his car into a studio. So he was sitting by this beautiful lake, having a rest. We were very lucky to speak to him.
Great. Should we have a listen?
Let's do it. Hold up. Before we start, we had the news late last week, as you'll know, that Trump himself has caught the coronavirus. That's despite seeming to mock Biden in the presidential debate for wearing a mask, and a few hours before the announcement, telling a virtual audience at an annual dinner that the end of the pandemic was in sight. This episode was put together before that news broke, so I wanted to alert you, otherwise you'll be wondering why on earth we don't mention it to Craig. But you will hear us talking about how much Trump massively downplayed the threat of the virus, which is pretty interesting knowing what we know now. Anyway, that's all. On with the show. Craig's not on yet, is he? There he is. Hey, Craig. How are you?
I'm started. I'll clap. Cool. I don't know if that helps link things up for you, but we're going.
Very good. Well, I really appreciate you doing this, Craig. I know you're a busy man, so this is fantastic. We're going to come on to President Trump's response to the coronavirus in a bit. But to start off with, you've been on the receiving end of one of his Twitter rants before, I believe, back in 2014, mm-hmm. when he was then Citizen Trump. Can you tell us why and what happened?
This morning, the first positive case of Ebola hits New York City. 33-year-old Dr. Craig Spencer, now in an isolation unit.
To some, one of the most arrogant guys in the city. To others, a hero.
Dr. Spencer returned to New York after treating Ebola patients in Guinea last Friday.
Yeah, in 2014, I was working in Guinea, West Africa, as part of the Ebola response. After having been there for quite some time, taking care of patients, obviously knowing that there was a risk I could get infected myself, I came back to where I was living in New York City. And a few days after I got back, I started having some symptoms and myself became sick with Ebola and went to the hospital where I was at for 19 days being treated. At that time, I didn't really look into it, didn't know. I wasn't even on Twitter, didn't know that now President Trump had sent a message. I think he specifically said, "You're one selfish doctor," or something.
You were vilified for what he said was bringing the disease to the States. And I can quote his tweet. He said, "The Ebola doctor who just flew to New York from West Africa and went on the subway bowling and dining is a very selfish man who should have known." For the record, I mean, people with Ebola are not contagious until they develop symptoms. And you were monitoring yourself in line with, you know, CDC right. guidelines and stuff like that. And you were sort of, you didn't know whether you would live or die, presumably.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, once I heard about a lot of the criticism and a lot of that vilification, it was tough because, you know, I would want and I would hope that people understand and expect that public health professionals, people that see the true impact of this disease, know what it can do to communities, aren't just going to go willy-nilly being irresponsible and going and doing things that could have resulted in others getting infected. And thankfully, nobody else did, including my now wife, who was living with me, no one else that I had contact with.
And it was another day of fast-moving developments in this coronavirus emergency.
New York City remains the national epicenter of the pandemic. It has more than a quarter of those sickened so far.
The number of hospitalizations here in New York jumped 40% on Thursday, just in a 24-hour period.
And this is overwhelming the city's hospitals and first responders.
So take us back to March. You posted a now famous Twitter thread titled, "A Day in the Life of an ER Doctor." About working on the front lines of the pandemic. Give me a glimpse of what a typical day was like at the height of the pandemic for you.
Sure, yeah. The way that I've described it is walking into the emergency room at that time honestly felt like the apocalypse. And I just have these visions seared into my brain of opening up the ambulance doors and just looking and just seeing dozens of people intubated on a mechanical ventilator all at the same time. And it seemed like some like alien spacecraft or it was unlike anything that I'd ever seen before. Maybe in the emergency department, we'll have one or two people intubated on a ventilator at any time, but to go in and have everything and everyone that you see in that state.
Even with Ebola, it was different compared to when you were in Guinea as well.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have mechanical ventilation. We didn't have a lot of stuff. We had really, you know, kind of basic interventions at that point. And so, you know, here when COVID hit, sure, not a huge percentage of people that got it got really severe, but so many people got it that they were flooding emergency departments. And there was a long time where we were worried that we weren't going to be able to keep up with the volume. I particularly worked in two different hospitals in New York, in Washington Heights, and then one even further north, right on the border with the Bronx. And what we saw at the moment, and definitely in retrospect, was that this virus was having a disproportionate impact on the outer boroughs, which is where Black and Hispanic New Yorkers live. Even the difference between those two hospitals where I worked, you know, 50, 60 streets, there was a big difference in the amount of disease burden and what we were seeing at one closer up to the outer boroughs.
Some states are reporting disproportionately large numbers of African American deaths.
New reports strongly suggest that race still matters.
Going to work at that time, walking on streets that were largely empty, that were super quiet in a city that never sleeps, but then to cross a threshold into the emergency department where everything is transformed, where there are fluorescent lights, you know, beaming off the goggles of your colleagues who just, you know, really weeks or months before never really had to wear goggles, and to see everyone masked up and in personal protective equipment, it was so disconcerting and so difficult for me because it was a space that I've known so well for so long, people that I've known and never have seen them in that situation. Then to go and see patients, when we saw a lot of COVID patients initially with their oxygen levels so extremely low in the 50s and the 60s, those patients you would immediately intubate and put on a respirator in normal circumstances. But so many of these people didn't look as bad as we thought they would. And then, of course, on top of that, all of my colleagues who had never worked in a place like West Africa during Ebola didn't feel as comfortable with this daily threat, with knowing exactly how to use your personal protective equipment, with all these things that I unfortunately learned, you know, in some sense, the hard way in West Africa, helped me prepare a little bit better for how I could respond in New York and help my colleagues understand how they could respond.
I remember you describing the cacophony of coughing, which was just so sort of visceral. And it was a detail that I'd read before, but just sounded brutal.
Yeah, you'd walk down this like corridor of coughing and you just hear different coughs at different pitches all throughout the emergency department. But that kind of quickly was replaced by this silence or sea of silence. And really the only thing that you heard was not coughing, but the monitors and the drips of patients who had been intubated, who couldn't cough anymore because they have, you know, a piece of plastic into their lungs to help them breathe.
And then there's the kind of the emotional side of it as well. When, you know, I wondered if you'd ever dealt with this before, but this phenomenon of people who were dying, not being able to say goodbye to loved ones. And that was a detail, again, that I've read about that just really struck me.
Yeah, right. When you come to the emergency room, our goal, what we've trained for our whole professional lives, is to save life, to save people, to do whatever we can, to do CPR, to help people who've been shot, that have been, you know, stabbed, whatever it is, we're having a heart attack. Our goal is to save lives. And so in this process of taking care of patients and knowing that some patients, if you intubate them, are not going to come off the ventilator, we had to really switch the way that we did things in our processes. And we started getting involved with palliative care teams who would come down and would help us talk to families over FaceTime, video with them, and say, this is the likely reality of what's going to happen if we do this, or if we do this, or if we do this, and just have really open, frank, honest discussions with family members to say, hey, what would your dad have wanted? Had he ever talked about his desire to be on a ventilator? What does your family want, knowing that the likelihood that he or she is going to come off this ventilator in any time in the next few weeks is near zero? Is it worth the pain? Is it worth all the discomfort for the patient as well as for the family to not be there, to not have a chance to say goodbye? Yeah, these are things that we weren't used to as emergency doctors. We had to really learn how to do really well, really quickly, because we did it all the time for me and for everyone else that I worked with. And not a day went by where one of my colleagues didn't call me crying, you know, wondering what we can do, looking for support. Many people saying, you know, this isn't what I thought I was going to do. I didn't necessarily sign up for this, but every one of my colleagues showed up for it every single day. Mm. And I think we got a lot of resiliency from having kind of our own personal support groups, you know, WhatsApp groups, or just calling people on a daily basis, checking in. I always thought it was really important to kind of have a buddy, someone that I would check in on, make sure they're doing okay if they needed anything, and kind of advocated for that for a lot of my colleagues throughout the city. We needed each other at that moment. And some of us got sick, some of us got exposed, some of my colleagues unfortunately did die from this virus.
New York and New Jersey mourning the death of an ER doctor who stopped breathing suddenly yesterday. His symptoms all consistent with coronavirus.
This is where a nursing manager passed away. He had been treating patients sick with COVID-19. This is where hospital staff members, so many of them, are heartbroken this morning.
It was really, really tough. I still think that, you know, a generation of healthcare workers, especially here in New York City, are going to be forever scarred by this experience, by what we saw, by what we did. And I'm hoping that we continue to do that self-care and the kind of group community care that we're going to need to make sure that we come out of this okay.
Craig, when the president was asked by an interviewer about the number of COVID deaths, he replied, "It is what it is.
I think it's under control. I'll tell you what.
How? 1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. And it is what it is. But that doesn't mean we aren't doing everything we can."
I think that was the moment when I just completely lost it. Up until then, I had been really disturbed by our lack of response, our non-response in some sense here in the United States, and knowing how much better we could have done. But hearing that callous cast aside of, at that point, I think there were, you know, 140 or 150,000 deaths. And then thinking back, and the first vision that came into my mind was being in a room in our emergency department, holding the hands of a man in his late 60s who had just turned off the ventilator, and I had just spoken to his family. And we had just made a decision that we were going to let him pass peacefully. And thinking of that patient and the patient a couple hours later that we did the exact same thing, and the patient a few days later where we did the exact same thing, each one of those was a contribution to that 140, that 150,000 deaths. And just having seen the impact that had on individual families, on the people on the other line, on the other end of that FaceTime call, and to hear it talked about in such a callous way of like, hey, it is what it is, it just really pissed me off. It just angered me to my core, because it is what it is only because we didn't do what we needed to do. And so many of those deaths were preventable. So many of those conversations with family did not need to happen, shouldn't have happened, if we had only taken this seriously from the beginning, and we didn't.
Many doctors think it is extremely successful, the hydroxychloroquine. I happen to believe in it. I would take it. I took it for a 14-day period, and I'm here, right? I'm here.
I want to read you these and get your kind of reaction. But the following are all statements that we've heard, not just from people spreading misinformation online, which we know is a phenomenon and a problem, but from prominent TV hosts and politicians. Mm-hmm. Hydroxychloroquine is a life-saving drug for COVID-19, and the Democrats are suppressing its use. T-cell immunity means certain regions are safe from infection. Wearing a mask is worse than not wearing one. The numbers of those who contracted COVID and the number of deaths have both been inflated. What's your reaction to all that? You must know that, I mean, you're on Twitter quite a lot, so you must know that this exists. I'm sure some of this has been tweeted, you know, directly at you.
Well, not only has it been tweeted at me, but, you know, specifically in the hydroxychloroquine issue, you know, for a while, not a day passed where I didn't get some type of death threat or something basically saying that I'm a murderer or a horrible person for not routinely giving hydroxychloroquine to anyone that walked through the emergency department doors. Look, this is symptomatic. All of those statements are symptomatic of this pandemic itself. You know, 8 months ago, we didn't know about this virus at all. And in the span of 8 months, we have learned an unbelievable amount, like the amount of scientific research that's been done, the fact that we're progressing towards a vaccine, like all of it is so unprecedented in how well we've been able to understand what's going on with the disease. At the same time, so much of that correct information has been undermined or really covered up by false information, by disinformation, you know, this deliberate misleading for a bunch of different purposes. And as someone who early on saw the impact of this, saw what it could do to families and communities, who early on, you know, not wanting to be on media myself, I didn't want to go on TV. That's not what I did. If I wanted to do that, I could have done that in 2014 and 2015. That was not my goal. But seeing how the narrative was being taken away from healthcare providers and public health professionals, primarily by politicians, myself and other colleagues that I worked with banded together and said, it's got to be our job to fight this disinformation, this misinformation that is deliberately being peddled by a bunch of different groups, most notably the person in charge of this country.
I still can't get my head around why the coronavirus has been politicized. Why is there disinformation about something so deadly? And also, you know, it's become an election issue. I mean, you're on this podcast. We're doing a podcast about the election and suddenly the coronavirus is an election issue. Why? Yeah. This is ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, let's be fair. All public health crises are going to have some political component to them. I mean, I say we need to separate the public health from the political, but that's nearly impossible to do. We need to amplify the public health over the political, and we need politicians to do their job, which is, again, amplifying public health principles, the knowledge. The fact that that hasn't been done, the fact that that is actively being undermined, has resulted in public health professionals becoming political targets, and we've seen this.
Well, this is just disturbing to hear. Dr. Anthony Fauci, a key member, you might even say the leader, of the White House coronavirus task force on many days, he is now facing death threats.
We couldn't believe it when we learned about this. He's been forced to beef up his security detail following growing concerns for his safety.
The fact that Dr. Fauci and his family are getting death threats is just pure craziness. This is a guy that for decades has, you know, run one of the premier programs focusing on things just like COVID in the world, and is really just this monolith of history and experience and information. Someone that should be out talking to the American public on a near daily basis, but that voice has been undermined, and it has been cast aside in favor of political talking points. I have to assume that the reason that this wasn't taken seriously, or that the reason that this administration tried sweeping this all under the rug from day one, is because they knew it would make them look bad. They knew that many of the actions that have been taken over the past few years by this administration, including getting rid of the NSC, the, you know, basically that pandemic preparedness person within the White House under Bolton in 2018, underfunding our critical public health infrastructure here in the U.S., as well as undermining public health response organizations around the world, including WHO. Like, so much of what we've done, or this administration has done over the past years, has set us up to fail in this pandemic. And I presume that they knew early on that that's exactly what was going to happen. So to take a stance where you politicize a public health emergency and hope for some better outcome than what we've had is just wrong and ignorant and unfortunate, because I could have told you, and any other public health professional could have told you many months ago, that this is exactly what we're going to see if this is the way that we responded.
When you treated the first COVID patient back in, I presume it was March time, did you think back then that there would be a day when there would be people who would doubt the very existence of COVID despite all the news about it?
No, I knew that was going to happen. This happens all the time. You know, working in West Africa in 2014, there was a narrative that this virus was brought in by outsiders, by people like myself. There were rumors that the disease itself wasn't real, that people were being killed inside treatment centers, that we were harvesting their organs, like all these other things. That's not because they're West African or because it was Ebola. It's because that's human nature, right? I think it's interesting how we maligned West Africans. And I say we as kind of Westerners. Oh, these ignorant people that can't stop doing their burials, or think that this virus isn't real, or are unwilling to lock down and quarantine in Monrovia so we can get this virus under control. Look, I mean, we've responded in the exact same way, right? Like, the viral videos that are hitting on Facebook and on other social media platforms are not of me talking about, you know, how to put on a mask correctly. They're about people who are taking fringe opinions around what medications like colloidal silver or hydroxychloroquine or other things that we know don't work, but which are spreading like wildfire.
As health officials struggle to contain the coronavirus, social media platforms like Facebook continue to fight the spread of misinformation about the deadly disease online.
Facebook and all the other social media companies are really grappling with what to do right now with just a wave of misinformation, false claims, hoaxes about the coronavirus.
Part of this is a failure on behalf of our public health community you know, going out and going on TV and doing interviews and trying to hit people with science and say, no, 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 but we know that that doesn't work. The problem is that that approach itself doesn't always work to combating disinformation. But it's not surprising to me that we have people saying it isn't real. It's not surprising to me that we have people saying you should take this under the counter or this over the counter elixir or medication to help. That happens all of the time. What is surprising to me is that we have people in charge making decisions who are saying those things despite the outcry from the public health infrastructure and the public health professionals that exist here in this country.
A quick word from one of our sponsors. Here's the thing about home security companies. Most trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, and lousy customer support. So while there are a lot of options out there, there's only one no-brainer: SimpliSafe. I tried this out. They send you a package with sensors and cameras. It's dead easy to set up, so you can blanket every room with peel and stick sensors in under an hour. And then professional monitoring keeps watch day or night, ready to send the police, fire, or medical professionals if there's an emergency. There's no contract, no hidden fees, no fine print. And it all starts at just $15 a month. I'm not the only one who thinks SimpliSafe is pretty great. US News and World Report named it the best overall home security system of 2020. So head to simplisafe.com/masses, as in huddled masses, and get a free HD camera for my listeners. That's simplisafe.com/masses to make sure they know that our show sent you.
The United States has become the world's worst affected country. And of the 25 top locations in the world for new cases, 15 are U.S. states.
Do you think there's been two-part question, really. Do you think there's been a deliberate undermining of science and public health expertise by the president? And also, if yes. So, how do we come back from that?
There absolutely has been. Look, where is the CDC? You know, this is unbelievable. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has been, up until now, at the forefront of doing the education, doing the research, and sharing that with the American people. We haven't had a press briefing or briefing from the CDC in forever, like months. They only did a few throughout this whole thing. That's absolutely, I mean, that's crazy. They should be out there all the time. We heard more from the president about what medications people should be on, what actions people should be doing, than we did from the head of the premier public health agency in the world. So to your question, did this administration actively undermine science and public health? Yes, undoubtedly, 1,000%. This has been going on since day one. It continues until today. I have zero confidence that that is going to change, regardless of what happens with case numbers and death numbers over the coming weeks and coming months. There has been and will continue to be an undermining of public health principles.
You mentioned doing interviews with other media organizations, and I wondered, mm-hmm. you know, as far as I'm aware, you've got nothing to promote, you know, no book, no documentary, but nope. This is important to you to correct this misinformation on COVID.
Dr. Spencer, good morning.
Good morning, Savannah.
Take us into what you're seeing right now. I think people see empty streets and they think,
yeah, I've spent what's different? Hundreds of hours of my life at this point, you know, preparing for doing interviews, talking to reporters, journalists, going on TV, on CNN, on Fox News, on MSNBC, on OANN, like basically any outlet I could. And to date, I've made exactly $0 from any of this. I've likely spent a lot more just preparing in my, you know, in my time, buying things to do these interviews, setting up, getting a nice shirt, stuff like that. My goal since day one was sharing my experience, because I think that what we saw on the front line in New York City was so visceral, was so powerful, and was exactly apparently what people needed to hear to try to take this pandemic seriously. I wanted to make sure that that information was being given to people directly, not filtered, and that people could do with that what they want. You know, some people will read what I write or listen to what I say and say, you know what, I don't agree with that guy. And that's okay, because quite frankly, you know, public health and science hasn't been 100% throughout this pandemic. They're not going to be. We're learning so much about this so quickly. We need to be transparent. We need to be accountable as well. But yeah, my sole focus has been to go on and say, look, this is what the science shows. This is what the public health shows. This is what's changed in the past couple weeks. And this is how we need to adapt.
Actually, it makes me think of, there's a British epidemiologist called Ben Goldacre. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's written books about public health and stuff. But I mean, you know, his kind of point is that there's a sort of fundamental scientific illiteracy among the public and the media. And I think that, you know, if the media who are writing about health, whether it be, you know, a crappy study that says limes can, you know, help prevent cancer. And when you actually, if rather than just report that, if you actually look at the study it was based on and find out it was, you know, one person in Wales in 1974 and it's meaningless. Right. You know, I wonder whether this sort of, this idea that, you know, we're the general public is scientifically illiterate. So that's where the sort of disinformation kind of creeps in. If something sounds plausible, people are going to kind of suck it up like a sponge.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I don't know if that's new by any means. One could probably argue that we're more scientifically literate than we ever have been. At the same time, we're forced to reckon with things like Google and Facebook and YouTube, which, regardless of your level of scientific literacy, if you get, you know, pushed into the right algorithm or the right rabbit hole, you could be bombarded with misinformation and not know whether what you're hearing is resonating because it's true or because it's fringe or because it's what you want to hear. The disinformation potential of social media agencies is so massive, and we're finding and we're seeing as data comes out that they have been one of the biggest sources of disinformation spread. There are studies that have been done looking at the number of deaths that have been caused by disinformation, largely through social media. Like, this has been our biggest issue. I can go on CNN or on, you know, Fox News till my face turns blue and, you know, 24 hours a day, but I'm only going to reach a small fraction of one audience, as opposed to if I have a viral video on Facebook that is seen by 21 million people in the span of 3 hours. Like, they're incomparable. With that being said, I think we need to think a lot about the power that social media organizations have over the content we see. And because this is a political podcast as well, like, not just for our politics, but for issues like this around our public health, this has been the biggest issue. This has been the biggest challenge for people like myself, you know, thinking about how we can use Twitter, how we can use these outlets to share the reality, but also recognizing that there are people who are slicker, who have a message that is going to resonate and it's going to go viral much more than any of my stuff will, because it seeps into something that people want. They want to know that there's an easy treatment. They want to know that the mainstream media is not sharing with them some secret that only they get to know about.
Tonight, the Oxford vaccine, a leading COVID vaccine candidate, is in advanced trials. And drug maker AstraZeneca says it will be able to produce 3 billion doses.
That could be the very solution to the pandemic the world is waiting for.
Prediction time. When are we going to see an effective vaccine, and how will the U.S. roll that out?
When will we see an effective vaccine? I think that that's going to happen soon. I think that probably by this winter we'll have one, if not more, vaccines that have been shown to be effective in terms of preventing people from getting COVID and that are hopefully very safe. I'm optimistic that we're going to have a vaccine or some vaccines. Now, in terms of actually getting them rolled out and getting them into the arms of Americans and people all over the globe, that's going to take way, way, way longer. Think about how many doses that we need for any vaccine that comes out. There's a good chance it's not going to be more than 50 or 60% effective in terms of preventing people from actually getting the virus. Any vaccine that comes out may need 2 doses, which kind of cuts in half the global supply of the hundreds of millions of doses that may be made pretty early on. How are we going to prioritize certain groups and make sure that, you know, maybe the elderly or frontline healthcare workers or communities of color are all targeted, because that is where the virus is most likely to take root and have the most deleterious impact. We need to start these campaigns now around information and continue that discussion with communities that in the past have been sidelined or have been marginalized, especially around vaccines. There's a big anti-vaccine community in the United States and other places in the world that we need to reach out to and get them to trust that this is being done, this is being rolled out in a way that's really, really safe. At the same time, so many of us who are watching this are super concerned, especially here in the US, that there could be pressure from this administration to brush through a vaccine or to approve something that under normal circumstances or in the normal fashion would not have been approved.
Like we've seen in Russia.
So yeah, exactly. Like we saw with Russia, you know, this big announcement that they've approved a vaccine and we haven't seen any of the data from phase two. And there certainly hasn't been any documentation from phase three, the kind of the gold standard of what we need to have before we're willing, before I'd be willing to take it or willing to give it to my family or even my enemies.
Do you believe states are opening up too quickly or too slowly? If you were president right now, what would you be telling governors to do?
I would tell the governors to listen to Dr. Fauci, listen to the scientists, listen to what the facts are. Look, this is this president has to focus on what's going on here.
Will a Biden presidency make any difference, A, in the fight against COVID, and B, in the future of healthcare?
You know, everything that I've heard and everything that I know about the platform for Biden has been to focus on science. And I spoke to Joe Biden and Barack Obama in early August, late July, briefly to talk about how we could have responded, how we should have done better, and how those lessons that we learned from Ebola in 2014 and 2015 could have been really, really helpful for us here. I think anyone that comes into office who focuses on and amplifies science is going to do a much better job than what's being done right now. I certainly have a lot of concerns that if we continue with the status quo, we will continue to deal with this outbreak well into next year and beyond. We know how to get this under control. We know it needs to be done to bring this virus to heal. We're not doing it because we're not making it a priority. We're prioritizing the politics over the public health itself. And again, that's the reason that we failed. That's the reason that we are failing now. That's the reason we continue to fail. Anyone, any decision maker who comes in and puts in place an agenda focused on science and putting public health out front, regardless of the political party that they're in, is going to do a way better job of handling this virus than is currently being done.
And presumably any future pandemic.
Yeah, well, that's going to have to be another discussion, right? Like, we as a species aren't particularly great at learning the lessons of our previous failures and bringing them with us many years and decades down the road. There needs to be a continued and a prolonged focus on not only how we reimagine healthcare, but how we think about putting in place these kind of permanent institutions and infrastructure for us to not only respond to pandemics, but to find them really before they start, to do the research in places where they're going to start from, and to have that infrastructure that allows us to respond early on as opposed to try to respond in the middle of it like we're doing right now.
So you think that in future, scientific experts are going to carry more weight?
It's hard to say. You know, I was quite optimistic early on. I saw that a lot of news organizations had doctors and nurses and healthcare providers out front speaking to the American public about what was going on, about the reality of COVID. I thought that was really great. I thought that helped people understand what we were seeing and how big their responsibility was in helping us respond. I don't know that that's continuing so well. And I think we've continued to see, as we've already talked about, the undermining of public health professionals in this country. I don't know how much more of a bruising we can take and still have people trust in us. We're going to have to do a lot to rebuild trust in organizations like the CDC, rebuild trust in science itself, because it has been so painfully undermined over the past couple of months. And I wouldn't be surprised if the general public's trust in us has declined significantly throughout then.
Wow. What a note to end on. Craig, I really appreciate you chatting to me, and I hope you enjoy your break in New Hampshire and that things kind of continue to sort of level off and quieten down as they have been.
I do too. This will have indelible and long-term impacts on who we are as a society. I'm just hoping that we take the learning and the lessons and the pain from every single one of these patients' hands that I held as they died, and from everyone else that died from this disease, and think about how we prevent this from ever happening again.
Well, just to be very American, thank you for your service. And carry on doing what
you do.
You've
learned well.
Really. Thanks a lot, Craig.
Thanks, Alex. All right, I'm going to end this recording. Thank you.
Alex, Craig was a nice chap, wasn't he? I enjoyed that.
Yeah, really nice bloke. And nice of him to actually talk to us in his precious time off as well.
And you are now quite literally an Englishman in New York, like your your hero and guru, Sting.
I don't know, Pete. I think you know, I just think about how fragile we are. But, you know, every breath you take is something that I think is good, you know. And you know, if I ever lose my faith in you, Pete, I'm gonna tell you that. But what I love about living in upstate New York is just looking out on the fields of gold.
Wow. And that was totally unprepared as well. Very good. Well done. What I was going to say, as an Englishman in New York with a slightly different take on things, even though you have lived in America for a very long time, what did Craig's interview tell you about divided America? And do you see hope for the future in terms of those divisions?
You know, I haven't lived in England for a while, but I see the same divisions over the coronavirus there as I do in America. So actually, I don't think this is uniquely American at all. I mean, you've had anti-mask protests in other countries in Europe as well, certainly in London. And people I follow on Facebook who are constantly posting stuff about how, oh, this is ridiculous, and, you know, this isn't working, and, you know, we need to get back to life as normal. And this issue is not exclusive to America. When Craig talks about the science and how we should follow the scientists, this should resonate with, or it should be applicable to, a lot of other places as well.
And he spoke about getting death threats, as many epidemiologists have. Did you hear anything from what he was saying that made you hopeful about the future?
You know, Pete, I think as far as the pandemic is concerned, no. I don't think America is suddenly going to come together over the pandemic. I don't think the issues are ever going to be resolved. There's always going to be those on the right that are kind of decrying the measures that are put in place to try and stem the tide of the pandemic that interfere with getting the economy back on track. And that's sort of, it for some people, that's more important. And so it's not going to be resolved. And also, you know, talking about Craig, you're also going to see people in the medical community on the front lines not being believed and receiving death threats. And that's really only going to stop when the pandemic isn't a news issue. And that's going to be a year away. Like when we've got a vaccine and enough people are vaccinated and all the rest of it, and it just becomes a non-issue, something we're not talking about anymore.
So this particular battleground, you weren't hearing things that offer resolution at the moment. What about the election? How do you think these issues are going to influence the election?
I think they will influence the election. What's kind of interesting is that I don't think the people that have decided they are proudly Trump voters are going to change their mind at all. But there are definitely, and same on the left, people that are proudly going to vote for Joe Biden and not going to suddenly think, oh, you know what? Trump's handling the coronavirus actually is brilliant. I'm going to vote for him. There may be a handful of voters still that are undecided, that are kind of frustrated by the way that he's handled the coronavirus. But it's worth also mentioning, Pete, mm-hmm. I actually did an interview with a friend of mine who is Dr. Chris Rose, who is a social historian of medicine based in Texas, for Stranger's Guide, which is this magazine that I work for as an editor.
Name drop.
Chris told me that, and this is fascinating, nearly every new disease has been politicized. And we don't have to go that far back in time. The HIV AIDS crisis was considered a huge failure for Reagan. There was a massive public panic around polio in the 1950s in the US, even though the president at the time, Franklin D. Roosevelt, was a survivor. So this is not new. This is not new. Pandemics have proved to be politically divisive in the past, and we are proving that again today.
Very nice. That's enough for now, I think, Alex. If I give you some music, can you give me some credits?
Yes.
All right.
Battleground is presented by me, Alex Hannaford. The producer and sound engineer is Pete Sale. The theme music is Three Girls by Hidden Twin. Special thanks once again to Craig Spencer for giving up his time to talk to us. Battleground is a DMT Media production for Audioboom.